The weird kid. No parent wants to admit they have a weird kid. Or at least they didn't want to admit that back in the 1990s, 2000s era that I grew up in. These days, parents are proud to brag that their 4-year-old daughter, Blueberry Sage, is vegan and anti-capitalist. But back in the 21st century cusp, you wanted an ordinary kid with a few featured fun facts that made them seem distinguishable. Well, Jeffrey has a penchant for his colors, enjoys dancing to Motown, and loves turtles. It's like fun and bubbly dating profiles, except instead of matching for love, you were swiping for points with other parents. No one wanted to say, my 4-year-old son has an obsession with Madonna, hates waking up early to open Christmas presents, and is reading at a 3rd grade level at age 4. That sounded cringy back in 1998. It's like finding out that the mozzarella platter that looked so good in the restaurant menu photo is no more than frozen mozzarella sticks heated up with canned tomato puree. Those above descriptors are accurate when it comes to little Matt Rebar. Apparently, and I say apparently because I don't have the memories, I made a scale-sized version of Madonna out of plastic food. We then mailed a picture along with some beads to Madonna. I don't know how my mom found an address. This was just shy of when we would sell our souls to Google. Another time I asked my principal in kindergarten if, for my birthday, they could play Holiday by Madonna over the morning announcements. The principal apparently wished she could, but then would have been bombasted by other students who wanted music played during their birthday. I'm fascinated with people who can actively remember large chunks of their youth. One friend had a memory of when they were 2 years old. I can't tell if they're just brilliant or lying. I discovered my earliest memory was a lie, or so my mother says. I have a clear, distinctive recollection of being slapped across the face as a child by my mother in the kitchen of our first home. I never slapped you across the face, my mother gasped when I shared my earliest memory, which didn't happen. Well, you definitely spanked us a couple times. I pointed that out as if a butt smack was the same as a full arm rotated swing face slap. That's different. I only spanked you a couple times. Doesn't that feel adjacent? My mother gave me a adjacent my ass look. One of the things my family and close friends are aware of is that my memory is comparable to a fish. I will forget names and events, mix up details and definitions, and actively rearrange reality. Notice how the title of this piece is called The Weird Kid, and not The Smart Kid, nor The Semi-Normal Kid with a Functional Memory of Reality? I don't have a publication house to confirm this, but that latter title feels too long. I was partially placed into kindergarten at the age of 4 because I could name the planets, and the order of the planets, and distribute fun facts about the planets. This was before Pluto was annexed for being too small. Size does matter, gentlemen. There were other signs that I was decently bright, at least smart enough to push into kindergarten right away. But I like the idea that someone knowing the planets is enough to prove one can skip a grade. Liz knows Neptune is a blue planet named after an old Roman god, so we'll have her skip preschool and start her in kindergarten immediately. Liz doesn't seem to be able to comprehend basic addition. So, she knows about Neptune, for God's sake! My mother once again found my memory to be lacking in this department. They moved you on because of your social skills, my mother recently told me over a glass of grape cider. You were emotionally intelligent. In 1998, being emotionally intelligent was not a thing a parent would brag about. But if I had been a young child of 2023, I would have been treated as a modern-day Socrates. My only memory of kindergarten was when the class got in trouble. Consequently, we couldn't play with the plastic kitchen and house set in the corner of the room. That toy system was the elite cream of the crop. It was like the Chanel of all the toys in the kindergarten classroom. But because of bad behavior, it was roped off like a crime scene had happened. Like there was a police investigation happening due to an assault by plastic food items. Before technology ruined my ability to read literature, I quickly crushed a book or two a week. A few of my elementary school teachers would softly complain about how I'd hide novels within textbooks. It was hard for my mother to take their complaints seriously because while the rest of the class was doing 2nd grade phonics, I was smuggling Harry Potter into my textbook and reading at a 5th grade level. The indiscretion usually went ignored. Back in grade school, we had an accelerated reading program. You could read various classic books and take a quiz on a school computer. It was a semi-optional reading test in which students needed a breezy 10 points per year. I remember constantly logging my points so I could be one of the year's top students. Besides, I was continually reading anyway. Toward the end of the school year, I'd make a mad dash for extra points by looking through eligible quizzes to see if there were any short books I could read and test myself on. Or maybe books I had read in the past that I could hopefully bullshit myself through a test on. One book, The 100 Dresses, was worth 4 points and had less than 100 pages. It was a book I could crush in a day, and a book that other students did to get their bare minimum points. Most people did accelerated reading because if you collected enough points, you could trade them in for prizes. 30 points got you a pen, 50 points accumulated you a toy, 75 points got you a dress down pass. Having a dress down pass in a Catholic grade school with a strict dress code was like having access to the best drugs in prison. Quite often, we'd have $2 dress down days where the student body would pay the school just so we could wear jeans and t-shirts. When I was in first grade, you could trade in your accelerated reading points for an exotic prize, lunch with the librarian. I was the only student who claimed the reward of dining with Sister Etienne. I had assumed that lunch with the librarian included a provided lunch. Like Sister Etienne would whip up something at the convent for us to dine over. I put in an actual food order, as if she was a private chef I had hired. Cheese broccoli soup, entree options, and even a dessert course.
"I don't think Matt understands that I don't bring lunch for us," Sister Etienne told my mother. "He gave me a whole food order."
I was still pretty excited to have lunch with the librarian, even if it was just peanut butter and jelly. Having your mother be a teacher at the school you're attending was never a problem for me. My mother didn't treat me differently just because I was her son. If anything, she probably treated me a little more harshly just to prove a point. And because my mom was both a great teacher and considered cooler than the other teachers, it was more of a benefit for me. Although there were times my mom had to lay down the law, people considered me deputy sheriff behind my mother. My favorite moment of being the teacher's son was when it came to my mother's birthday. One of the faculty had brought in a cake for my mother's birthday, and I was walking by the library, which had turned into the faculty room halfway through my time at school. The old faculty room had to be converted into a classroom following the expansion of kindergarten into 2 separate classes.
"Matt!"
one of the teachers called out, and I turned to see a flock of teachers having lunch in the library.
"This birthday cake is for your mother. Could you go see if she'll let us have some? We're about to finish lunch."
I was taken aback at the request, but walked to my mother's classroom. She was proctoring an assignment. "The teachers in the library were wondering if they could cut into your cake," I said, a bit neutral, but with the look of the audacity. "Sure," my mother said without a care in the world. My mother wasn't that much of a dessert person anyway. She appreciated that someone had got her a cake, but she wasn't dying to eat the whole thing. I arrived back in the library with permission from my mother, only to find out that the birthday cake had been sliced into. Pieces were already being distributed to the teachers on early lunch. My mother said it was okay, I meekly informed the room.
"We figured she'd say it was," said the teacher,
cutting out another slice with a brimming smile. I turned around and left. For the most part, I'm a goody-two-shoes who wants to avoid conflicts and problems. I still am to this day. In my 8 years of elementary and middle school, I was only written up 3 times for bad behavior. Classmates would get into squabbles or act out in rare situations, but my 3 demerits came from 3 ridiculous situations. Fourth grade, picture it. The weird time when you don't feel like an older kid, but you don't feel like a younger kid either. My teacher was Marian Patterson, an old school academic who could deliver information successfully and had a sharp whip tongue that didn't take prisoners. Her big obsessions were clowns and penguins. We decorated laundry hangers with old pantyhose to make freaky hanging clown mobiles. She was also a notorious smoker, and she handed back essays that smelled like nicotine. I remember we read The Wizard of Oz during class, and we'd often be told by Miss Patterson that the book came before the movie, and that the book was better than the movie. Another memory of Mrs. Patterson was when I accidentally, or maybe purposefully, but I genuinely can't remember, left behind an assignment with a lousy grade. Every week, we bunched and stapled our papers and assignments to give to our parents. It was like a flower bouquet of grades.
"You could have placed that bad grade at the back of your packet," Miss Patterson said, raising a stapler to staple the rotten grade on top of the packet. "But now that you tried hiding the grade, we're going to put it right on top."
That was an excellent and aggressive way of demonstrating responsibility. It carried the shame that Cersei probably felt in Game of Thrones when the nun rang the bell and cried out shame for her entire walk throughout the city. People ask me why I feel guilty, upset, or shame over specific actions. I point back to my Catholic schooling and upbringing. It has me in a tighter grip than the Suez Canal had on that ship that got stuck for a week. I wish some modern grade school teachers had Miss Patterson's blend of tough love and real-life application. I always found her sound, except when she wrote me a demerit. I was sitting next to Gus, a goofy and friendly classmate. Someone in our quad of desks had farted, so Gus turned to me.
"Matt, you farted,"
Gus said, beginning typical fourth grade blame and attack games. "I didn't fart," I retorted back, both truthful with a shade of defensive. Getting accused of a fart was the grade school equivalent of murder. Naturally, kids avoided this charge super defensively, and human nature makes us think the super defensive are often guilty of the charged crime.
"You farted,"
Gus shook his head, as if he were defending his position on global warming. "I did not fart," I repeated, this time a bit loudly and firmly. Miss Patterson overheard and immediately zeroed in.
"What kind of language are we using in the classroom?"
Miss Patterson yelled, like I had dropped a significant no-no term. The room was confused at this point. Those who hadn't heard me probably thought I had declared a dirty comment in front of Miss Patterson.
"We do not speak bathroom language in my classroom," Miss Patterson said, taking me to her desk.
She pulled out the pink paper of death, a demerit. I didn't feel bad for what I had said, but now I had to explain to my poor mother what had transpired. Years later, my mother recalled the incident with relish.
"I really didn't care," my mother said with a chuckle. "It was fart. You didn't say a bad word, but what could I say? I wasn't going to punish you, but you were too young to say, this demerit's bogus, so I just let you take the punishment without much comment. I actually laughed about it in private."
In sixth grade, I got a demerit because I wasn't wearing a belt. Back then, I was apt to forget that my blue navy pants demanded a belt per the school uniform. Miss Oliver was a stickler for the rules. She was also known for her ancient history lessons where we would mummify oranges in ancient Egyptian burials and play ancient Greek Olympic games.
"No belt again. That's a demerit."
I don't recall my mother complaining much about that demerit either. I definitely was building up a reputation for bending the rules. When tasked to read a chapter out loud in Miss Oliver's class, I'd create remarkable voices.
"Matt gave an interesting voice to a 10-year-old girl," Miss Oliver muttered to my mother once. "She sounded like a southern truck-driving, cigarette-loving woman in her 50s.
The third demerit happened in 7th grade. I had Miss Picorni, an older, thoughtful, and kind woman. She had trouble with authority, especially as pre-teenagers and budding teenagers are apt to rebel against some figures. She had been convinced that students couldn't hear her at some point. I don't know which students tricked poor Miss Picorni into believing that, but lo and behold, Miss Picorni invested her cash into getting a Britney Spears-style microphone attached to a speaker at the hip. I don't think it helped much, because while her vocals were a bit louder, the cheap speaker offered crinkles and feedback. After school, my classmate Ryan and I stayed back, because it was our turn to clean the classroom. We were given watered-down solutions and rags to wipe down desks and seats. Ryan jokingly sprayed me, and that turned into a spray war between the two of us. We let loose, watered-down cleaner flying across the classroom. Bullets of spray flew at each other like two werewolves tossing saliva haphazardly. Miss Picorni walked in right when I sprayed Ryan right in the face. She howled as if we had been shooting each other with real guns and ran to Ryan's side.
"What are you two doing?"
she cried before making Ryan flush out his eyes with water. Both of us went home with a demerit for biological weapon warfare, or whatever Miss Picorni described in the demerit sent home to our parents. Eighth grade graduation was a colossal deal at my elementary school, since the cream of the crop was leaving and never coming back. My friend Sarah cried in the parking lot during the last moments of our pre-high school life.
"We'll have to have a 5-year anniversary and see everyone again, right?" Sarah said a few times, to the agreeance of some and the indifference of others.
It would soon become impossible to bring that truth to fruition. Two of my classmates would commit suicide, one committed a murder-suicide, and another would go on to overdose. 4 deaths in a class that was somewhere around 50 strong. I can't help but feel a bit eerie over that statistic. I wouldn't love to see half of my elementary class. Some of my old elementary classmates were really problematic apples. The biggest irony was that the class suck-up during the DARE anti-drug education became the biggest drug user. A couple other people grew into fundamentally twisted ideologies, and while I can appreciate the memories, I have no desire to open up a modern can of worms just to say, "Remember when?" 50 times over in a church hall. I vaulted into high school with the same weirdly popular personality, but not in the traditional sense.
At an all-boys high school that valued sports over art, academics, and anything that didn't involve physical combat, my interests and activities were not high on the cool scoreboard. But I was active, too active, in clubs that I probably had no business leading. I was actually the president of the Relay for Life Club, and I still don't know why. I had no background in running, nor any personal connection to cancer, but someone needed to step up, and I have always been a yes person. This sounds terrible, but I don't remember much of high school. I remember trading any shards of math and science skills for English, history, and art. I took additional art and English classes and dropped my language during my senior year. You only had to take 3 years. I was taking Latin and barely learned the subject. The only word I remember is agricola, which means farmer. It's not a traumatic reason why I've forgotten, but high school makes us anxious and wrapped up in perception. For a short while, I donned a cocoon that I shed upon college. I carry no regret, for it is part of the natural order of modern schooling and adolescence. You start off open, become close quickly, and then slowly become open again. When I was in college, I quickly felt a bit worried about my image. I had spent high school ugly and unsexual, but now I was finding that I desired self-beauty. I hit the gym pretty quickly. I was constantly eating salads in the college cafeteria. Those salads were often made with kidney beans, black beans, chickpeas, egg, and tomato over spinach with a Thousand Island dressing. I don't even think that salad was that healthy, but it was less about an actual calorie count or the health of the salad and more about that I was just eating a salad. It was like saying, we're going to the best winery in Cleveland, but in reality, you were going to some lady's garage where she poured you glasses of Aldi. I was blind to the situation, as if I were a contestant on Netflix's show Love is Blind. I didn't marry someone sight unseen. I just fooled myself into thinking my habits and current state were optimal. Freshman year felt like a weak version of 90210. Not only had I been eating salads around the clock, but I actively walked over to the CVS to buy weight loss pills on a shelf for $20. I used them, but they failed to do anything. That motivated me to go, oh, this is useless? Before my transformation, I layered many clothes as if I were Amish or an Italian grandmother who was always cold, no matter the temperature. My hair was long, curly, and moppish. Add glasses that didn't fit my face, and I looked like that ugly nerd in an 80s movie who got bullied by the mean jocks. However, there became a quick turning point, March or April of my college freshman year. I shaved the mop down and got contacts, taking the ugly duckling and evolving into a decent 7 out of 10. Who knew you needed contacts and a Grey Clips coupon to meet society's expectations? With the confidence given to me by new hair and contacts, I tried on my first penny, a mesh tank top. It's the kind of look you could wear as a basketball athlete, but for some reason, I enjoyed it. I displayed my creamy shoulders as if they were Versace. I liked the jock look. It felt different. And maybe it wasn't necessarily about coming across as a jock, but just doing something different. The penny was the gateway clothing item to my impending and current obsession with tanks. Before the tank, I would wear t-shirts to the gym, but now I'm most likely attending workouts with the gun show open for business. I've always admired my thighs the most. Thick, strong, and muscular, my thighs are clearly the top shelf liquor of my body. They're like two security guards at a club, formidable and possibly overbearing. Those elephant trunks really do an excellent job of holding me up, and if my thighs were real people, they'd probably question my tank choices. I'm sorry, my thighs would grunt. We've always been hot, and yet you choose those decent shoulders over us? I go through ensemble pieces like a character on Riverdale or other cheap tawdry shows. There was Varsity Jacket Matt, a phase where I wore a $45 Urban Outfitters knockoff varsity jacket. I wore that varsity jacket to the point where the faux leather was cracked and wouldn't button across my slightly increasing gut. My stomach and chest were like continents breaking away from Pangaea. There was slight movement gradually over time. I never woke up to find my chest noticeably bulkier. There was Bandana Matt, who took up his massive curls and slid a bandana over them. This was when I kept my hair long and looked for ways to style it properly. My optimistic yet naive self didn't realize there was no way to properly wear that hair. Looking back, Bandana Matt was the most brutal. I looked like a Yankee, trying to be a southern peach farmer or wannabe biker who would probably do better if they played with Hot Wheels or grabbed onto a biker Lana Del Rey style. Best to leave bandanas to leather daddies and bald men. It should not have been a surprise that when, upon finding the hidden beauty, I began to show off that beauty by shedding clothes. And in that cycle of wearing sexier clothes, it was evident that jorts would eventually roll up into my ensemble. Homemade jorts, to be specific.
I was a college student on a budget. I still rock a jort, but not as aggressively as I used to. Bandanas are to jorts, like how people complaining to the manager are to those who directly write refund demands to companies. Both seem like a waste of time, but one does seem classier than the other. My thighs were happy to see some sunlight and a few peekaboo eyeballs. I was unstoppable and indestructible, husky, giant shoulders, and formidable iron thighs. Feet draped in work boots, sometimes a tank to add more skin. People would turn their heads, wondering if they had witnessed Jesus' return. A more prominent man, confident about his body. I was no Paul Revere who rode while screaming that the British were coming, but I'm sure my tube tank, low-ride jorts, and work boot combination might have caused a wayward scream here or there. My fashion sense evolved somewhat over the years. Years of sexless fashion resulted in a bit too much show. Eventually, in my mid-20s, I would find the correct balance. My friend Brett recently pulled out a photo of us at a dance formal. Oh my god, what was I wearing? I texted back. The image of me, short militant hair, sunglasses, a green blazer, a blue and orange shirt, bright green pants, was way too much color and style for one single look. I can imagine fashion stylists poking their eyes out. I don't have the confidence that it takes to be a nudist, nor do I get pleasure from being nude. I love tanks and shorts because they provide privacy while allowing breathing room. My voluptuous body tends to overheat. I wear tanks as much as possible. I have all sorts of tanks, some perfect for a casual picnic, others so low cut they're almost to my navel. My body feels freer when allowed to sometimes spill casually out of thin fabric. And when you have shoulders that bounce off of your chest due to their size, you appreciate tanks more than shirts. My tanks become a superior meter in whether I've lost or gained weight. Oh, this tank used to be loose, but now it feels tight, would be the story of what would lead me to a week of mere salads. I hit the gym early on in college. I started going late to avoid the competition over weight racks and bars. At John Carroll, the gym space was called the Corbo Room, named after some weightlifter long ago. It should have been called the Corno Room, because it was a constant battle to grab a cardio machine or any weight equipment. I actually worked at the gym, and it was one of my favorite jobs of all time. You swiped cards, did whatever you wanted on your laptop, and occasionally cleaned some gym equipment. I wish I had a job where I did minimal work and could crank out stories or surf the web. The other college job I loved was working for the campus coffee shop, The Cubby. I don't even know why I was hired. I had a little catering experience and retail experience, but I was far from being a barista. That's where I met Karen, one of my closest friends to this day. Karen and I would spend hours inventing drinks and designing posters advertising our beverages. There was always drama happening at the Cubby, sometimes because of student staff, but more so the non-student staff who worked at the sister establishment. There was an employee who was caught stealing food on the security cameras. There was a disagreement over a chicken wing special. Employees coming in drunk or high. My favorite non-student employee was Miss Donna, an older, quiet woman who slowly waltzed around the place. Miss Donna liked her work, but she wasn't a fast worker. She would take minutes to make a single drink, but everyone, including me, loved her. At the time, I thought she was just old, but she probably was performing the amount of work correlated with her pay rate. Midway through my tenure as a campus barista, the administration decided to have a non-student work a new morning shift at the Cubby. Before that, our shifts ran from 5:30 to 9 p.m., and from 9 p.m. to 12:30 a.m. every night. It was a simple nighttime establishment. But now, a morning employee would open the place up around 7 a.m. and keep it running till 2 p.m. I don't even remember the original name of the morning lady, but she quickly became crowned with the title of the Morning Lady. I would never meet the Morning Lady, but I had heard stories of her prowess. She dyed her hair a Ronald McDonald red and apparently had a very jittery appearance. She would put forth rules for all nighttime student employees and considered herself management. She was never a manager. The Morning Lady changed display cases and would clean things, but make them dirtier during the cleaning process. She even made a drink called the Flying Monkey that she would push onto people, so much so that we received complaints for how often people were asked to have her disgusting drink. The Morning Lady was eventually let go and replaced with Adrian, who became a bossier yet more put-together version of the Morning Lady. My favorite Adrian story was that she started a communication folder, which turned out to be a series of diary entries by Adrian blaming the student employees for everything that was wrong with the place. A squashed blueberry on the floor, It was the student employees. Dust underneath one of the tables outside the cubby. It was the student employees. Adrian made a drink wrong. It was the student employees. The biggest frustration I would have as a barista had to be people who didn't know what they were ordering. A cappuccino is typically espresso with a bit of milk and a giant cup of foam. Half of a traditional cappuccino is nothing more than milk foam. Quite often we'd have people order them and be upset when it wasn't sweet and milky, like you might get at a self-serve gas station. With that in mind, I would grill everyone who ordered a cappuccino.
"Can I get a cappuccino?"
girls would ask. "You know, it's mostly foam, and it doesn't have a lot of milk."
"Oh, can I have a latte?"
The biggest rush of the week would be Sunday following night mass. With prayers handled, the next thing people needed was their late-night caffeination or a smoothie situation. Sometimes the meanest people are indeed the ones sitting in the front row at mass.
"Why is it so slow?"
someone might mutter from the back of the line. Cindy, 40 people are ordering expensive coffee beverages, and most don't even know what they want when they arrive at the front of the line. They spread themselves out in a position to indicate they're relaxed. They eye the menu slowly in the mannerism of a rich entitled person who might examine a box of Fabergé eggs.
"Can I? No, maybe not that. I can't decide. Well, should it be that drink? This drink? That other drink? This other drink? Or maybe that drink over there?"
Sometimes the indecision made no sense. Sure, should I have chocolate or white chocolate in my latte would be a toss-up. But some people had no clue, as if they wanted hot or frozen, caffeinated or caffeine-free, or maybe they want a smoothie instead of a coffee. I'd have to parse through their decision-making like a classroom aide helping a child put together a block tower. Midway through my last semester, the shop transformed into a capitalist nightmare. Instead of serving organic products, we would start selling Starbucks. Creativity on the drink menu had been sliced out altogether. Phenomenal boss Rachel, a friend to all, left for better coffee grounds. Her absence made the incompetence of other managers spiral out of control. I was thankful for not only graduating from college, but graduating from this job. And while I haven't made a latte since 2016, if you got me back in front of an espresso machine, I'd have no trouble cranking out a double. My frustrations as a barista became tenfold in practicum when it came to serving. Upon graduation and completing my year of service, I decided to look for options with some good side money. Cleveland was gearing up to open a Margaritaville, undoubtedly a weird geolocation for the brand. When I thought tropical getaway, I did not think of Cleveland. And weirder yet, the site of the Margaritaville was in the popular kids' party district. Nobody is trying to get drunk and club at Margaritaville, especially when they close at 10 p.m. That summer was a soft trauma for the staff. We'd get slammed and would overseat people. The kitchen was too small for the whole restaurant. Things would get more backed up in that kitchen than in a colon cleaning commercial. Because of how much we worked, we would steal quick bites of nachos and appetizers in the back during long shifts. Our tables got cranky for the wait because the small kitchen and limited staff would become indifferent over the multitudes of orders. The food wasn't even that good. Think Applebee's, but you're paying more. When people would get pissed at me over their frozen appetizers taking a half hour, I'd internally believe it was their fault for eating here in the first place. I don't believe in victim blaming, but you can't blame the cheesy establishment for having bad food. One of my defining love languages is map exploration and creation. I love analyzing maps and roads, looking up places, and geography. It's not even for some weird geography quiz fetish, although I could probably tell you a few state capitals and the locations of countries. My family jokes because on the standardized testing, I scored in the 99th percentile on maps and directions. My pedigree is never used. I always map my way to destinations. I couldn't even tell you the names of highways, and I've been regional to Cleveland for almost 3 decades.
"Did you take I-90?
This is a question that quite often ends up with this answer. "Which one is that again?" Like most kids who grew up in the 90s and early 2000s, I loved Roller Coaster Tycoon. For those who missed out, it was a computer game where you could design roller coasters and manage a park.
"One of the teachers in your old school thought you'd be excellent at city design," my mother explained.
"That kind of makes sense," I said, "but it's not because I scientifically know how to design a city. I would just have the aesthetics down. Don't ask me to make sure the plumbing and electricity work, but I would make sure the city looked pretty." I loved developing my own fantasy maps with coastlines, mountains, port cities, fields, and volcano craters left abandoned. I created maps for stories I would eventually write and would share those creations with my classmates, denoting where they would live and rule.
I remember one map featured towns named after my friend's first and last names. Sammyville, Mace City, Sarah Wickentown, Blazevic Town. At the time, I thought it was the coolest thing. Looking back, I cringe when reminiscing about my on-the-nose artistry. It isn't just maps that make me weird. I have an amusing attitude when it comes to inanimate objects. Take cars, for instance. My first car was a Chevrolet from the 90s. I remember it was thick and brown, the kind of car that could take up two spots and not for any good reason. It was a gas guzzler. Hummers get more gas than these cars. There wasn't any fancy buttons or doohickeys. This car was meant to drive, and that was it. I was 19, and driving a car that crappy seemed part of the standard human experience, alongside experiencing buffalo chicken dip or having a bad experience with one type of liquor and never drinking said liquor ever again. The concept of driving was still new to me. I had skipped the whole phase of getting my temporary driver's license at 16, mainly because I didn't want to spend money taking the classes. I would watch the driver's education classes, which were an after-school, almost extracurricular, in the shanty classroom that looked more like a basement storage facility in the school's basement. There would be slideshows of what car accidents looked like and some serious discussion. A lot of the time, it looked like those kids were watching movies, like Fast and the Furious or something. "Don't drive like this, kids," the teacher would say to a bunch of high school juniors and seniors as Vin Diesel flips a car over the highway like some Tony Hawk skateboard move. I took my driver's exam at 18 when I didn't have to take or pay for the class. By that point, I had plenty of experience. Driving with my dad was too easy. He'd fall asleep occasionally in the passenger seat while I sweated nervously. Was that turn too sharp? Was I okay to run that green light? I remember one time I missed the exit, so I had to get off at the next exit to turn around. My father, awoken by the brakes, was quite upset that we had driven past the intended exit. "How did you miss the exit?" my father asked in a tone that implied I had not only missed the exit, but rammed down five cars since and was on a destructive driving rampage that could not be stopped. Needless to say, we were back on the road, and he was back asleep soon enough. My mother was always the more encouraging type. She was helpful early on and explained fundamental driving tips without the fast and furious visuals. After practicing in the parking lot, she wanted me to drive on the street. Nervously, I turned onto the road and went 0 to 40. We screamed for a few seconds before I pulled into the next driveway, which ironically was the police station. I've only had 3 speeding tickets in my driving history, one of which was bogus. I got caught going 40 in a 25, but every time I drive by the scene of the speeding crime, the speed limit sign says 35. Add that to my list of things I may never get over. My father is notorious for getting a speeding ticket a year, a fact that he almost boasts with bravado. While some might topically talk about their trips to Maui or their interest in medieval feudalism, my father likes to mention that he's Cleveland's equivalent of John Wayne with speeding tickets. People say I'm reckless when I'm driving, although I don't see it. I'm not a fan of those, "let me pump the brakes and go 2 mph on this turn" turns. I'm not a horrific speeder, but I believe in efficiency. If the off-road route saves me 2 minutes, then that's the route I'll take. I'll also avoid tolls, but that's not reckless. That's economically smart. I have a habit of blaring music, podcasts, and audiobooks, but if that's reckless, then it's just as irresponsible for someone to drive in silence, which is unthinkable. My first car, that thick Chevrolet, went out with a story that my parents still hold over my head. I basically was unaware that cars needed oil changes and neglected that car like it was Oliver Twist in the orphanage, and it soon died on me. I wasn't stupid enough to not know about oil changes, more so forgetful that I should do my due diligence to get an oil change. After killing that car, I was blessed to find a family friend who sold me their beat-up Trailblazer for $300. I made that Trailblazer last for about 2 or 3 years. Like the Chevrolet, the truck was a gas guzzler. Taking a trip down the block was about 1/8 of the tank. It was a bit beaten up, but it had character. You'd look at my Trailblazer and think, well, that car has plenty of stories. After the bumper fell off due to rusty nails, the car looked like it had come out of Mad Max or some apocalyptic movie. Having a Trailblazer meant that we frequently used my car to shepherd groups of friends to various weekend events. Most specifically, Thursday nights out to Coventry, a 10-minute drive west of campus. Coventry is like a miniature San Francisco. Some drugs, some coffee, some gays, some fashion, plenty of alternative cultures. This culture's most Caucasian college element included a local chain featuring audacious Thursday night specials, a nearby hookah bar, and some weird basement arcade place. I was more of a fan of the now extinct La Cave, an underground wine bar that initially didn't have phone service. You'd have to see if your friends could talk without needing their phones. In my Trailblazer, we could fit anywhere from 7 to 9, not as comfortably, to 12 in emergency situations. We'd barrel down Cedar Road like the first space mission, cramped in and holding our breath as the Trailblazer whirled to life. If you asked me to list everyone who rode in those Trailblazer Thursdays, I'd only be able to come up with one-third of the crew. Sometimes it was friends from Group A, and other times Group B. Fraternity brothers would come along to see their current romantic interests. Random friends of friends would come, people I would never see again. It was like SNL in a car. You never know who would show up, and sometimes even when they showed up, you had no clue who they were. They would take any ride, even if the car seemed like it was going to fall apart by the wheels at any moment. After college, the Trailblazer began to show signs of fast age. There were steering wheel issues and brake issues. Hell, the whole car was an issue. My remedies included shrugging and assuming that the vehicle would explode one day. Not in a ball of fire, but more of a soft sigh, like, "Well, sorry, man, it's time to be hitting the old dusty scrapyard." It got to the point where my mother demanded I stop driving the Trailblazer. The "I'm driving a death trap" jokes had gotten her too riled up. "I'm afraid you might die in that thing," my mother confessed. "It's been keeping me up all night." "Really?" I questioned, doing that thing where you raise your eyebrows in a way to say, "That sounds a tad over-exaggerated." Many things kept my mother awake, like she was some ghost medium who was visited by spiritual hauntings every night. "I thought about that part-time job you took. It kept me up all night. I thought about where we went to lunch the other day. Maybe we should have gone elsewhere. It kept me up all night." It finally got to a point where the Trailblazer was practically undrivable. It got traded for what probably was only 2 cents, and I got a used Nissan Rogue 2008. The Rogue was quite an upgrade, a bit sleeker than its two predecessors. It was like when your first two college classes were with ancient old men, and then your third college class was with a younger professor whose eyes sparkled with possibility. Like a relationship bent for a destructive finale, I was initially in pure love with my car. I loved it even when the radio died, something familiar within the car species, I'd find out. I loved my Nissan even when it had a leaky transmission, which meant I had to give it weekly oil-ups. I loved it even when the AC and heat fan went out. That meant I drove a giant ice cube in the winter. I loved that car even without a left mirror, with its broken taillight bumps and dents, and even when someone smashed the entire passenger window to steal a roll of quarters out of my car. I would have rather paid the guy $50 to not touch the vehicle in the first place. My Nissan, like the Trailblazer, involved a rusted-off front bumper that gave it a Mad Max look. I decided to trade in my rolling hunk of metal to get $4,000 off a brand new Mitsubishi, which was an incredible deal, considering that my Nissan Rogue was more like a beaten-down, unhoused Rogue. It didn't take long for me to dirty the brand new car. Like the cars before, I treated the vehicle as more than a transportation tool. It was an emergency closet, filled with clothes shed throughout the day as sunlight kicked in, and gym clothes that had been changed into or out of, left in the car for future Matt to utilize. Another aspect of my car that close friends and family can attest to is that it's full of recycling. My parents instilled a heavy sense of personal responsibility in me regarding recycling, to the point where I will gather my recyclables and leave them in my car to form a dumping ground of spent plastics and papers. It will get so bad that people look in my vehicle and gasp. Part of me wonders if it's less about recycling and more about just dumping things in my car and handling it later. Recently, I came across a post on social media that talked about ADHD. I'd always wondered if I had ADHD, but managed to train myself to easily overcome the obstacles. So what if I couldn't swim in a straight line? I just learned to move straight but swim in different directions. The post discussed how those with ADHD will only complete something if it features uniqueness, challenge, or urgency. The post explained that washing a single dish isn't unique, challenging, or urgent. A pile of dirty dishes isn't unique or challenging, but it poses urgency. So when it becomes critical, the plates will get done. Reading that made me gasp, for there was a giant pile of dishes that I had been ignoring and would forget until they absolutely consumed the kitchen, leaving me without clean plates for future meals. I had chalked up so many quirks to personality and artistic tendencies,
but maybe I was justifying questionable behaviors and the recycling in my car. Was that being altruistic or just a sign of undiagnosed things happening under the roof of my brain? There are a few things about me that do seem a bit different. Some of them are little things. A penchant for asking complex or nuanced questions to strangers, talking to coworkers about personal matters way too quickly. But maybe it's not a matter of being different. But I have too much to give. Throughout my life, I've created 6 alter egos who fully flesh out the ever-evolving persona of Matt Rebar. The first persona was a music one, Reebstar, my persona that focused on my entertaining and artistic side. Reebstar would eventually become Rybar. Reebstar is the bold showstopper who sets off with a vision. He's the one who wants to put on a show and make everything grand and opulent. Reebs came second. Unlocked like a video game avatar in freshman year, he's the competitive jock, obnoxious and loud. He will probably scream and yell throughout the match if you have him on your volleyball team. Reebs likes to work out, which is a bit too much for some people. Father Time came out of a student union meeting where I was berating people for not having enough time. My good friend Molly has used Father Time as a nickname ever since. Father Time is the philosopher and balancer who manages time and space around him. He's quieter and harsher than the other personas, filled with my ever-abundant sense of justice and the occasional hard stance on a rule. Father Time reflects how I bind myself to specific and particular norms that the other personas otherwise ignore. Matilda is the justice warrior and logistics queen who enjoys a good coffee. She's the one planning events and theme parties, the one sitting on councils and the avid activist. Matilda came to me when my old roommate Dorica had to fudge that she was living with men. Instead of living with Matt and Dan, she resided with Matilda and Danielle. For Dorica's family, I became Matilda, but Matilda eventually became a part of me. Todd was created out of a discussion I had with some random at a bar called O'Reilly's. O's was an Irish Dove pub-type establishment close to college grounds. It was an excellent place for a weekday drink or 5, and there were darts in the back of the bar that seemed like an incredibly risky aesthetic for drunk college people. I don't think I was ever carded at O's. They either trusted you were 21 or trusted you to shut up about it. I told someone about the previous 4 personas, and they countered with a question. "So are you not normal?" the stranger asked with a joke. "Is the Pope Catholic?" At that time, he might have been before there was a Jesuit Pope. "Well, I can be normal," I explained, as if normality was some hyper-final form in a cartoon where I had to unlock and push myself to some ultra-final dangerous form. You know, normal, like professionally, or if you were to meet someone's parents, you know? We all have to gloss over our personality sometimes, and that's Todd. The traditional facade, the family-friendly archetype that wouldn't embarrass you. He wasn't the most prevalent persona, but he was deep inside and part of my personality. Honeysuckle Ginseng is my persona who loves design, social media, drama, and gossip, and is a master of relationship and sex advice. I think of her as having pink and blonde hair, done up curly and bold, in a time when hairspray ruled the streets. Honeysuckle is insightful, poetic, and sensual. Like most of my other personas, she is also strong-minded and stubborn, but Honeysuckle can easily woo you into compliance with hidden aggression. Young Matt came from my boss's comment, which inferred that I was young. The character that came out was aggressive, the rule-breaker, who kind of got up in your face. He was the boldest version that would stand up for those who cannot stand up for themselves. I used to believe that wearing masks or framing ourselves was wrong. Why would we hide our genuine selves? We shouldn't feel like we have to put on a mask for someone, right? But then, part of me thinks that a complex solar personality uses covers and frames to present a specific version. When I become the bland Todd, he's not taking over my whole essence. He's a slice that I'm currently utilizing for the situation. And I don't think it's fake, it's just how the world is. You might think, but isn't it a terrible way to perceive the world? I might agree with you if I wasn't having fun. My mother and I ran into an old family friend at a baseball game, Mrs. Fisher. Miss Fisher has 2 kids of her own, Eric and Aaron. They are similar in age to my sister Annalise and me. We go back to when we were younger, having met at theater camp. My mother and Mrs. Fisher were both educators, and they bonded over that, along with having kids that got along. I can't imagine having a child be friends with another child whose parents I can't stand.
Aaron, Eric, my sister Annalise, and I ran as thick as thieves at preteen and youth theater camp, art camp, science camps, anything enriching for some pretty challenge-needy kids. We hadn't spoken to them in a long time, except for social media interactions.
"I've been meaning to reach out, but I don't have your number," my mother exclaimed to Mrs. Fisher.
Miss Fisher began reciting her digits, and my mother gasped,
"Oh my gosh, you're in my phone!"
My mother looked mortified, like she had accidentally backed over and injured a bald eagle.
"I can't believe it."
Miss Fisher has one of those laughs of character. You know the type, a distinctive laugh that denotes an individual. You can hear that laugh and immediately recognize the person. For Miss Fisher, it's a quick staccato of deep throat yet high-pitched bursts of barks. One of the clearest moments I remember with Miss Fisher was when Eric and I watched television and came across Family Guy. Miss Fisher walked into the living room and was absolutely aghast. Upon sharing that story, my mother pointed out that even though my memory was awful, I seemed to remember memories with high emotional value. Back then, I wasn't just putting on my goody-two-shoes. I was runway walking and showing them off constantly. The idea of making my friend's mother upset was scary to a young kid like me.
"You know, Eric's getting married."
Miss Fisher stressed the word married like she was the pastor from The Princess Bride. "I think I saw that on Facebook," I said. Eric was one of the 25 people that Facebook decided I should know everything about. I often disagreed with Facebook's choices, but this one was correct. I liked seeing what Eric was up to.
"Eric's making bagels now," Miss Fisher exclaimed.
Instantly, I was both hungry for a bagel and desiring the chance to make bagels myself. One thing I loved about Eric was that he was constantly reinventing himself, whether by personal desire or the world around him. I like to think that I have the same aptitude. It didn't take long for my mother and Mrs. Fisher to bond over childhood stories and memories of simpler times. Their favorite story involved my 6-year-old self having a wardrobe malfunction. According to my mother, I often rocked commando as a youth. My poor mother had to be told one day that I should have underpants on so I didn't flash anyone while changing. Poor 6-year-old Matt didn't know that he was technically flashing his child junk at many innocent bystanders. I remember Annalise's starring role, Aaron added. She was one of the alcoholic angels in Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat. That play had alcoholic angels? My eyebrows shot up in a Puritan-esque belief that such a wonderfully colorful, family-friendly play shouldn't have angels who have hit the bar for happy hour.
"The rendition we'd put on did," Aaron chuckled. "It was one of the creative decisions Mr. Schultz made."
Mr. Schultz was the director of the plays, a very bold, happy guy who knew how to put together a production and send a sassy lash against someone. He was actually the one who donned my theater camp nickname, Billy Matt. Saying the name out loud makes me think of a version of me that sports a mullet, shoots gigantic guns, but also loves musicals. It's the name you might see on a modern retelling of The Little House on the Prairie. I don't even know the origin of the name. I'm guessing I played a character named Billy.
Aaron's nickname at camp was Princess, Miss Fisher mused, which caused Aaron to roll her eyes in memory.
Aaron might be strong and bold, but she wasn't a princess, unless she was one of those modern Disney princesses who transcended the stereotype.
"Did he have nicknames for everyone?" I said. "And if they did, were they all a bit rough?"
Before we left, Aaron commented how it felt like a decade hadn't passed, and I had to agree. Time is weird. You never know when the last time is, or if it's the last time. And that goes for venues, friends, families, activities, and places. No one's actively saying, today is the last day I'll ever visit Lake Erie. You don't return, and probably don't actively reminisce about it on a chaise lounge like a dramatic Jane Austen character. Sometimes the ribbon that's been running long naturally runs out, or it's cut dramatically, and you see the possible length of the ribbon fall to the ground. But so often the ribbon keeps rolling, or it's reconnected. What is cut becomes glued together or taped. Or it's just a new ribbon with the same old person, place, or pleasure. What could that have been?
"We'll definitely see each other soon," I said, hugging Aaron close. How often do we say this to figures, acquaintances, or workplace friends who have faded into the past? We rarely know when it's the last time we see a casual friend. But this time I meant it, and hope I'm not reading this essay years later, having left another ribbon on the table unrolled.
"You and Aaron vibed more than you and Eric or Aaron and Annalise," my mother commented after we left. Maybe it was an age thing or a gender thing, but who has time to parse demographical query about an old friendship? That was an interesting comment from my mother, and I mused about my friendships over the years. I had friendships that spanned the gamut of diversity, but it felt like I was probably pushed to have more male friends. My closest male friend in grade school was named Joey, and he was kind of a weird kid as well. My favorite memory was when we made nachos at his parents' house, which were burnt to crisps. "I want to be a chef when I'm older," Joey told me as we waited for charred black nachos and cheese. The nachos had evolved into the plastic I would eventually hoard in my car. My parents didn't love my friendship with Joey. I wasn't sure why until I discovered that Joey's father was a dirty forensic scientist. Maybe that's why my parents discouraged the friendship. I ended up looking him up, and he looks married, so I'm glad he didn't melt the marriage like those nachos.
"You know, Mrs. Fisher had quite the compliment for you," my mother said with a sparkle as we left the baseball park.
"What was it?" I asked, ready to hear that I was friendly, fun, or funny.
"Well, her compliment was interesting to me," my mother continued, "because originally I was thrown off, but the more I thought about it, the more I understood what she meant."
"Now you have to tell me what she said." I was like one of those Willy Wonka factory kids standing in front of the most tempting candy I had ever had.
"She said you were always listening to others. You gave them all your focus."
I agreed with my mother. I had never considered myself someone who focused in general. If anything, I had a lack of focus. What was missing from my life was a severe strain of stress, but maybe Miss Fisher had identified something in me that I had overlooked. Did I give others unconditional attention, focusing on their conversation and needs? Maybe sometimes. Even in the mid-late 20s of my tiny human life form, I'm still confounding the binaries inside me. I'm still confronted with my old personality, as large as a giant serpentine and often shedding old skin off of itself. Add on top of that the perceptions and comments of others. Each person in my life would probably say different things. Maybe similar words, but with different assigned emotions. I think they could agree, if not on the word weird, that some synonym is applicable.